Leo XIV has occupied the throne of Peter for exactly 1 week. How is the new pope already setting the tone for his pontificate? And what challenges lie ahead? The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal are here. Foreign policy expert Dr. Waleed Faris discusses President Trump's recent trip to the Middle East. And producer and Emmy Award-winning actress Patricia Heaton talks about her latest project, Unexpected, the world over. Begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you tonight. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and always at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube.
The pontificate of Pope Leo XIV is well underway. Here to reflect on the first week and with analysis of what Pope Leo and the Universal Church will face in the months and years ahead, I'm joined by the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. We are a week into this new pontificate of Leo XIV, and as he gets down to business, he had a few notable audiences this week that I want to explore. Cardinal Sean O'Malley, the former Archbishop of Boston, longtime member of Pope Francis's so-called C9, that Council of Cardinals who advised him, and the president of the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Children and Minors, met with the new pope. And so I want to start there. Bob, give me your thoughts on why do you think he met with Cardinal O'Malley right off the bat? Do you think this had to do with the governance of the Vatican or the protection of children and minors, which has been a challenge under Pope Francis?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we're all kind of groping around to figure out what these first initial things that he's doing signify. And you would have to think that because of the prominence of Cardinal O'Malley in protecting victims of abuse, and we know that he even stood up a couple of times, particularly in Chile, for example, to Pope Francis because he thought that he wasn't handling the things well. This is one of the two major issues that is going to be facing the Pope, along with many, many other issues, of course, and it's the abuse crisis and the ongoing crisis of the finances. So it's not surprising that he met with a fellow American, too.
Yeah, and one who has a good lay of the land in Rome. Father, how significant was the other big audience of the week, really, right off the bat, with the moderator general of Opus Dei, Monsignor Fernando de Ocariz? In 2022, Pope Francis issued a motu proprio that sought to modify the structures and governance of Opus Dei, it being a personal prelature. Where does that stand at this moment, and how might Opus Dei be handled differently under Pope Leo?
I think it's significant that the prelate of Opus Dei, so-called either prelate or moderator, was granted an audience. My guess is that the Opus Dei prelate asked for the audience and it was given. He was accompanied by his vicar, Monsignor Fazio. So it's important because Opus Dei has been under, we could say, examination in view of many changes that Pope Francis began with Code of Canon Law. He changed the nature of prirational prelatures, which is what Opus Dei is. The Opus Dei used to be under the Congregation for Bishops. Now it's under the Dicastery for Clergy. And Opus Dei has been updating its statutes. In fact, the process has been going on for more than a year. And according to press reports, Opus Dei's proposals have been turned down up to this point by the Vatican. Now, interestingly enough, the day that Pope Francis died, Easter Monday, Opus Dei began its general meeting in Rome with representatives from out the world, and they were going to examine the statutes. Well, they postponed the statute examination in view of waiting for the new pope. So I imagine the prelate of Opus Dei went to talk about that, and Pope Leo has a knowledge of Opus Dei because Peru, Opus Dei is very well known, and in fact, the Diocese of Chiclayo, where he was the bishop, previously had an Opus Dei priest as a bishop. So I think it's very significant, and I hope and pray that Opus Dei will, you know, be given a canonical hearing that will include all the elements that make up the personal prelature and how it, any changes would have a negative impact on Opus Dei.
Hmm. Also this week, Pope Leo addressed the Oriental Churches, the Eastern Rites of the Catholic Church, for the Jubilee of Eastern Churches, and he quite beautifully celebrated the Eastern tradition. This is what he said, and I want to explore this. He said, "The Church needs you. The contribution that the Christian East can offer us today is immense. We have great need to recover the sense of mystery that remains alive in your liturgies, liturgies that engage the human person in his or her entirety, that sing of the beauty of salvation and evoke a sense of wonder at how God's majesty embraces our human frailty. It is vital, then, that you preserve your traditions without attenuating them for the sake, perhaps, of practicality or convenience, lest they be corrupted by the mentality of consumerism and utilitarianism. Father, your thoughts on Pope Leo's celebration of the beauty and mystery of the Eastern Rite liturgies, and what might that indicate about the treatment of the traditional Latin Mass, especially in the wake of Pope Francis's Traditionis Custodis, which suppressed the old rite?"
No, I praise Pope Leo for what he said. The Eastern liturgy is beautiful. It's going back, you know, to the beginnings of Christianity in the East, the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, being one of the primary liturgies, and it was written by a saint, and it's preserved in its beauty up till this time. All of that is true. Liturgy is meant to bring the soul into contact with God, and God is a mysterious, invisible presence. So the liturgy tries to make visible and sensible those elements of mystery. That's exactly why people have been asking the Holy See to continue to allow the traditional Latin Mass to be celebrated without restrictions or even its suppression, as Pope Francis made clear he was interested that everybody go to the new Mass. So I think this is a good sign for those who like the traditional Latin Mass. And I would say the whole church should learn that, you know, having different liturgies is a way to express in common our search for God and God's coming to us in mystery through worship.
Bob, I want you to comment on that, and then I'm going to add this. I mean, that bit about attenuating, don't attenuate your traditions. I mean, that to me would indicate that he has a reverence for these traditions and the supernatural power of the traditional Mass.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly seems to even have emerged in the way that he's been conducting himself during his own celebration of liturgies. Look, I wrote a column just this week that my most emotional moment in Rome the past couple of weeks is when I went to a Byzantine Rite Catholic Mass at Santa Maria in Trastevere. I mean, it was just utterly otherworldly. And as wonderful as the emotion was in St. Peter's when the Pope was elected, this was really something. I mean, this really touched me very deeply as well. And I noticed in the conversation, in the discourse that he offered to the representatives of the Eastern Church, that he used an Augustinian phrase. There's a famous phrase of Augustine where he talks about beauty ever ancient, ever new. And he used that phrase when he talked about the depth of spirituality that the Eastern tradition has been able to preserve. And its importance, because it comes from a church that very often, because it was behind the Iron Curtain, because it's been dealing with militant Islam, has survived through suffering and yet has brought this great beauty and depth. And we need it. We need it very desperately in the West.
You bet. Yeah, and Bob, I mean, you leaned into the next part of what I wanted to ask you. During that address to the Latin, or Eastern Rites, rather, Pope Leo implored Christians in these often war-torn regions not to leave their lands despite the violence surrounding them. Bob, you've got a new book on martyrdom out now, which is an incredible read. We've addressed that shrinking population in those ancient communities for years. How significant is this focus of Pope Leo on the persecuted Christians this early in his pontificate?
Well, I want to say his election displaced my promotion of the book in Rome last week, which was originally the reason why I was supposed to go over there. But I of course, I noticed that because I had just written this book. It just came out last month. And what he's asking is actually for heroism and holiness, because if you read about the conditions of Christians in these historic Christian communities that go all the way back to the first days of the church, I mean, St. Paul on the road to Damascus, that's one of the most famous episodes in the early part of the church. And millions of these Christians have been leaving. Bethlehem, where our Lord was born, has been greatly reduced in the number of Christians there. So for him to say, don't leave, and be brave in your circumstances is really to call not just for holiness but for heroism. And he's also been working previously with Aid to the Church in Need, which supported the book that I just wrote, which has been trying to rebuild communities in the Middle East in particular and encourage people to come back. So I think we're going to see more of that. For the fact that he raised that up right now at the beginning, I think that that is a significant moment.
Father, something Pope Leo did not mention in his address to the Eastern churches was synodality, nor was it mentioned in his audience with journalists, which we'll get to in a moment. But the Vatican Synodal Office made a grand pledge to support Pope Leo, noting that, quote, the synodal journey continues under his leadership. Your thoughts on Pope Leo's omission of synodality in these two meetings, despite his early mention? And what do you make of the push from the old synod guard here?
Well, it's hard to read into silence, whether it's because he had other important things to say and didn't want to bring that up, or if he was intentionally leaving his side. We really can't interpret the tea leaves on that. He did mention synodality both in his remarks from the loge or the balcony when he was elected, and then he mentioned it also in the Mass he celebrated in the Sistine Chapel with the cardinals. What remains to be seen, of course, is how he understands synodality, because synodality is largely an undefined term. Now, if we look at it historically, as we've discussed on this program, synodality goes all the way back to the apostles. It means meetings of bishops. And then Paul VI, following Vatican II, established the Synod of Bishops as an institution, not part of the not part of the Roman Curia, but attached to it in a sense, which was to bring bishops from out the world to Rome to talk about current problems. Pope Francis took it in an entirely new direction, where he made it basically a meeting of every category of the baptized, to kind of together come together with the Pope and figure out what to do, but thereby diminishing the importance of bishops and then confusing roles. So I'm not sure what Pope Leo's understanding of synodality is. My hope and prayer is that he will restore what Vatican II intended, which is that the Synod of Bishops is a Synod of Bishops, and that the input of laity and others, such as priests, deacons, and religious, that's all advisory. It's not determinative, because bishops alone are the shepherds.
Yeah, this will tell us the direction of this pontificate and, you know, which way he's tending, this definition of synodality. Cardinal Jean-Claude Hollerich, the Relator General of the Synod on Synodality under Pope Francis, weighed in this week when asked about Pope Leo and what he might do about fiducia supplicans. That's the document Pope Francis issued allowing the blessings of same-sex couples. Hollerich said this, about fiducia supplicans, I hypothesize that the new pope could reinterpret but not abolish it. By the way, the church does not intend to equate same-sex unions with marriage. In fact, the declaration places the emphasis on the fact that every person is blessed by God. Bob, your thoughts on the cardinal's assessment there. Hollerich also acknowledged that Pope Leo follows in Francis's footsteps.
Yeah, I think that's an expression of a pious wish on the part of the cardinal, because everything we know about Leo is that he's been strongly opposed to what he calls gender, you know, recognizing genders that don't exist, and the soft way in which same-sex couples are somehow, it's not, they're not equated, but it's kind of implied that they're on the same glide path, so to speak, as heterosexual couples. So I'd be very surprised, actually, if he doesn't take a much more robust step about fiducia supplicans. Whether he will repudiate that document outright, which I think he ought to do, by the way, it's hard to say. But one of the things that I think all of us are noting about him right away is he really speaks in clear terms. But, you know, we're not any longer in this game of ambiguity and saying yes, but not entirely yes, and no, but not entirely no. I think he speaks his mind forthrightly because that's the kind of person that he is. And it will be interesting to see if he does turn to that document, how he handles it.
Yeah, Father, during and following the conclave, a story surfaced that claimed that there was some kind of agreement between the current pope and Cardinal Raymond Burke and traditional-minded cardinals. I got into it on the Arroyo Grande podcast this week with Vatican journalist Diane Montagna. Listen.
There is a major story out there that Pope Leo, then Cardinal Prevost, attended a meeting at Cardinal Raymond Burke's apartment before the conclave. I have spoken to about seven sources about this. Three of them confirmed to me, both very close, all three of them very close to both sources here, parties here, who tell me that meeting never happened. One said it was an out-and-out fabrication. Yes. Your take on this?
No, it never happened. I have it on the best of sources that that meeting never happened. There were a lot of cardinals speaking before the conclave, and the mere fact that cardinals were having meetings should not be something that bothers us, whether it's the progressives, the center, the right. That's the normal thing to do. What would we expect the cardinals to do when they haven't met for so long? Except come together and meet and talk. That's perfectly natural. But this rumor going around the Cardinal Prevost had gone to Cardinal Burke's apartment and that they had spoken, it's completely false.
If you want to fully understand the conclave and the movements that led to the election of Pope Leo, visit a Arroyo Grande show on YouTube. This episode on Pope Leo's path to the papacy is worth watching. You should subscribe anyway. Our posse episodes are also on fire. Go to RaymondArroyo.com for the links. Father, why do you think stories like this were so ubiquitous? I mean, were they created to kind of calm traditionalist fears? What was this?
Well, I think this is part of the journalistic frenzy during the conclave, since they, you know, don't have any microphones in the Sistine Chapel. Everybody's got to try to identify, well, what do the tea leaves tell us about what happened before they went in? So making assertions about who saw who, promises. You know, both Pope Leo and Cardinal Burke are canon lawyers, and they know that it's forbidden to make promises for provision of jobs and the like, you know, before voting for someone to be pope. Now, it's quite clear that the cardinals have an interest in knowing what each of them thinks. So asking questions at the general congregations or at other settings is fine. But, yeah, the idea that he was seen going into the building where Cardinal Burke lives, you know, this has been debunked. And we shouldn't imply any sinister motives to Cardinal Burke or to Pope Leo because they're both right. honest men and they're, you know, going to do what they think is right.
Father, that canon lawyer point is an important one as well. Pope Leo also took aim at what he called polarizing language when meeting with the world's journalists. He said, in today's media culture, we need a calmer tone in communication. Here's what he said. Let us disarm words and we will help to disarm the world. Disarmed and disarming communication allows us to share a different view of the world and to act in a manner consistent with our human dignity. Bob, he seems very conscious of the media and this media environment, certainly aware of the effect of rhetoric in the public discourse.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing is that at the same time, he doesn't give you the impression that he's trying to implement some kind of media strategy or he's being manipulative. Again, I think he's speaking from that Augustinian heart of who he actually is. And he would like us to, I mean, maybe this gives us an indication of where he's going to go with synodality, because obviously there's been a lot of heated rhetoric about what's going on in synodality. And for people to really make any kind of progress about contested issues, they have to be willing to be sincerely there to listen and to learn from one another. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's we know that in the secular world, I mean, the world is just going absolutely crazy, not only here, but in other developed nations as well. It's a difficult thing at this moment. And the church itself, let's be frank about this, is itself very deeply divided the way that the secular world is. And we're passing into a new moment. And I'm interested, I'm going to myself be paying attention to the way that he's drawn some parallels with Leo XIII. Where he thought that Leo XIII had noticed a revolution that was taking place at the end of the 19th century. He sees one taking place in 2025, a different type of revolution, but nonetheless one that needs to be managed.
Yeah. Among the major challenges facing Pope Leo as he embarks on this pontificate is the Vatican's dire financial situation. Numerous reports show that the Vatican faces a budget deficit of around $94 million, but I've seen it much higher than that, and a pension fund imbalance estimated to be between $600 and $700 million unfunded. According to a Reuters report, just before Francis was admitted to the hospital in February, Pope Francis was facing strong resistance from senior cardinals when he pushed for budget cuts. Father, what might he do, Pope Leo, to curb some of these expenses? I mean, let's start with papal nunciatures, which cost the Vatican about 41 million euros back in 2021.
Well, this is a big issue for the Holy See because the extent of its activities is worldwide, but its source of revenue has shrunk and it is not adequate to fund what the current obligations are. Now, nunciatures are important because the Pope sends nuncios, bishops, throughout the world, and they are the ambassadors to the secular government of the country where they are, but they're also the representative of the Pope to the hierarchy of each nation. So each episcopal conference, each country, that's how the Pope communicates with them. And the nuncios, most critically, are the ones who compile lists for new bishops to be assigned in the country they're responsible for. Now, you can save money by combining some nunciatures, which they already do. There are many smaller countries which have one nuncio for, let's say, four or five or six different countries. But it's important to know that nunciatures in certain countries where the interest of defending the church is paramount, where you might have persecution going on or a government that is seeking, you know, to curb the influence of the church, having a nuncio present really makes the Holy Father present on behalf of all Christians. So this is an area they should do some careful study and figure whether cost savings would unfortunately hamper the mission of the Holy See, or they can reconcile those two things.
Yeah. Bob, the Dicastery of Communications, which is kind of shocking, that's the biggest portion of the Vatican's budget, 43 million euros in 2021, just that year. Your reaction to that, and what might they do to streamline those operations?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were all shocked when we saw those numbers come out, because as we've said many times, it doesn't seem like the communications in the Vatican are particularly well handled. There are even between different parts of the Vatican, there often doesn't seem to be very good communication. I think even Francis, if I'm remembering this right, was talking about paring back Vatican radio. Is it really effective? Yeah. I mean, I'd be sorry to see it go. I remember as a kid, I think, listening to Vatican radio in Latin and thinking how wonderful it was that, you know, this language that hardly anybody knows is being broadcast to the world. But there, too, when you have deficits like this and you have obligations like they're looking at, you may not want to go into doge mode inside the Catholic Church. But there are only two ways to solve this. And one is to raise more money, which no doubt Leo is going to be doing. And he probably will be leaning on us in the United States more than in the past. And you have to cut costs. And this has to be serious. Pope Francis started out with some serious attempts to reform the finances in the Vatican. He put in structures, he brought in Cardinal Pell, for example, but then things didn't seem to go anywhere, and as often happens in the Vatican, it just kind of fell apart. People were fired, people were thrown out of offices. That's an unfinished business that needs to be taken up, and soon.
Yeah, he started a committee, I know, Pope Francis, I think it was last year, a sort of donation committee. But that's usually the last refuge, you know, when things get really dire, you know, the fundraisers start coming in. When I think, at least in terms of the church, if you're giving people the truth and you're doing it in a winsome, exciting way, that money naturally comes in. You don't have to push it. You know, Mother Angelica just said, keep us between your gas and electric bill. That was her fundraising apparatus. It worked. Gents, I want to talk about the atmosphere in Rome at the dawn of this new pontificate. Archbishop Georg Ganswein, who was Pope Benedict and Pope Francis's former personal secretary, told Corriere della Sera that Pope Leo, quote, has started well. Now a new phase begins. I sense a certain widespread relief. The season of arbitrariness is over. We can begin to count on a papacy capable of guaranteeing stability and relying on existing structures without overturning or disrupting them, end quote. Father, How has the tone in Rome and in the Vatican changed? What are you hearing?
No, I think Bishop Genschwein makes a very good point, and you've got to recall that he was a victim of what I consider to be an arbitrary decision on Pope Francis's part. Pope Francis removed him as head of the prefect of the papal household, which is his prerogative, but then he forbid him to live in Rome. He didn't give him an assignment, but ordered him to vacate his apartment in Rome and go back to Regensburg, his diocese. When he went back to the diocese, he had no assignment there. And he languished in that position for at least 6 months or more. Now, God bless Pope Francis, because then he made him a nuncio, and he's currently holding that role in Lithuania. But remember, Cardinal Burke's salary was cut off because Pope Francis said that he was a source of disunity. These kind of actions shocked everybody in the Roman Curia. And then recall what he said once in a meeting with the Curia. He said there are a lot of leprous courtiers working in the Curia. Yeah. Which is really a slam word kind of usage. And, you know, you say to yourself, well, if they're leprous courtiers, remove them. You know, don't keep people like that around. But he didn't do that. So it's sort of like, you know, being nasty to the people who work for him, but then leaving him in place. I think that's all going to end right now, has ended, because from all appearances and from his, you know, previous media appearances, this is a very reasonable, soft-spoken, listening man. In fact, that's one thing I like to highlight. Everybody I'm reading says that Pope Leo, when he was the bishop and missionary, listened to people. That's the place to start if you want to restore social harmony in the Holy See.
Mm. Yeah. Bob, in Germany, Bishop Franz Josef Overbeck is saying the rise of Leo could dampen hopes of reform in Germany. Your reaction to that?
Well, it all depends on what you mean by reform, doesn't it? If he means that it's likely to dampen hopes of a radical separation from the universality of the rest of the Catholic Church, there may be some threats to that. But I would hope that that Pope Leo is going to bring some fresh energies to that situation. Look, we have talked about this before on this show. Francis was very harsh toward, at least the people who worked for him were very harsh toward the traditional Latin Mass. Meanwhile, there's a much, much more radical, schismatic possibility coming out of Germany. And so something needs to be seriously done about that. And otherwise, we're going to have another split in Germany like the previous Reformation. I mean, we can't have one church in which homosexuality is being blessed. There are women priests and women deacons, etc., and another in which the rules are entirely different. I think that that's going to be a hard, hard thing for Leo to take on. But he's the kind of guy, you rightly say, who he gives you this impression, and I think that this is also interesting about him. He gives you an impression of a guy who listens, but at the same time, he's his own man. And he isn't harsh in the way he responds. He seems to have charmed a lot of the bishops he came in contact with when he was the head of the dicastery for bishops. And that may have had some effect on why it was that he was elected. But there's both strength there and a kind of openness. And that, to me, is a very interesting and an attractive combination.
I'm told by some cardinals and bishops who are close to him that he apparently went through the blades when he was working at the dicastery for bishops for the last couple of years, because many of the suggestions he made, many of the candidates for bishop that he offered Pope Francis were kind of dismissed summarily. And I think he's very aware of what precedes him and what the remedy might be in these days that he has certainly much more control and influence over. Finally, a bipartisan group of lawmakers led by West Virginia Republican Riley Moore is introducing a resolution to officially congratulate Pope Leo XIV on his historic election as the first American pope. And Vice President J.D. Vance and his wife, as well as Secretary Marco Rubio and his spouse, will lead the U.S. delegation to Pope Francis's inaugural mass on May 18th. Gents, very quickly, your thoughts on the American response thus far to this first American pope. It is incredible.
This is remarkable, Raymond. We have an American pope. You know, the Catholic Church in the United States was originally a missionary church, and now we've become, you know, the supplier to the world of the first American pope. So it's a great honor for our country. It's a great honor for, you know, Pope Leo's parents and all of his ancestors who remain faithful to the church. I'm glad that the United States government is making this effort to recognize the uniqueness of this situation. The important thing, of course, is that the people of the United States need to know that the Catholic religion teaches that God is sovereign over the whole world. Therefore, the Pope represents God in the world, and we need to remind people of that. God does rule over all nations, including our own. So under God, we have to obey his law, and we have to be a light and a beacon of hope and charity for the world. That's the important thing we need to keep in mind.
Yeah. Bob, very quickly, almost out of time.
Yeah, and I think that that's what the Pope has already been emphasizing, that and it's that deep Augustinianism that he has in himself. He clearly is emotionally attached to the United States, to Latin America. He spent time in Italy. He speaks five different languages, but you know he can communicate very easily. But it's wonderful that at this moment, in our own tumultuous time here in America, that we've got an American Pope, we've got a delegation going over there, and I can't wait for him to come here.
All right, we will leave it there and await that moment. For commentary from Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray, visit thecatholicthing.org. Thank you, gents. We'll check in with you soon. President Trump wraps up a multi-day visit to the Middle East with stops in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE. What does he hope to achieve? With analysis, I'm joined by foreign policy expert, co-host of the War and Freedom podcast, Dr. Waleed Faris. Waleed, what is the significance of these meetings? And tell us about the deals between the U.S. and these Gulf countries that are being announced.
Very, very significant what has happened. The president went to Saudi, Qatar today, the UAE. These are three major players in Middle East politics, in Arab politics, in relationship with the United States. But let's be clear. On the business level, on the financial level, it was a smashing victory. You know, 600 million up to a trillion from Saudi Arabia. That's big. 1.2 billion from Qatar, that's also big, but 1.4 trillion from the UAE. So this alone could act against our debts, just this volume. It's enormous. Of course, there were other political matters. Number one is basically, you know, to call on the Islamic regime in Iran to stop their support to terrorism and then call on all the other Arabs to encircle basically that regime. And last, probably the most important to me, is the Abraham Accord. There was a clear call by the president directly to Mohammed bin Salman that you should come and join the Abraham Accord. That's the vehicle, that's the tool for the future.
Yeah, but Waleed, I thought Saudi Arabia was already a participant in the Abrahamic Accords. Was I wrong in that?
No, it was not a formal member of the Abraham Accord. What the role they played. You know, I was part of the genesis of these conversations, summer 2016. Mm-hmm. And I remember I spoke with you about it at that time in the fall of 2016, early 2017. Saudi Arabia played the role of convincing all these partners who came to the front, the UAE, Bahrain, and later on the other countries that joined, that go ahead, go. I'm here to make sure that the jihadis are not going to play games with you. It happened in May of 2017. And of course, during the summer of 2020, the formal document was signed and Saudi was always expected to continue. But problem was, and we had that discussion, is that in 2020, Trump didn't win. And we had another administration, which actually paralyzed the Abraham Accord, paralyzed all the projects of Trump for 4 years. So now it is as if we are out from that grave and back to action and moving towards the second phase of the Abraham Accord.
Yeah. President Trump also held an extraordinary meeting on Wednesday, Waleed, with the president of Syria, Ahmed al-Shara, just a day after announcing that the U.S. would lift sanctions on that country, a move that would ease the economic stranglehold on the nation that is seen as central to stability in the Middle East. He received a standing ovation for the announcement. Tell me the impact of lifting those sanctions.
I'm going to tell you two stories. The story, the formal story, which is basically Trump is going there and in coordination with his Arab partners, we're talking about $3 trillion. Mm-hmm. And of course, his ally, the main ally, Mohammed bin Salman, the next one, Mohammed bin Zayed. And they asked him, they said, look, we need to stabilize Syria. For them, it's very important. Otherwise, Turkey will go in. Otherwise, the jihadists will go in. Mm. So he accepted to do two things, a photo with the leader of that government. And second, a commitment. He asked him, you want to recognize Israel. He asked him, you want to come to the Abraham Accord? That's to Giuliani. Reality is that the second story is that it's a challenge, and we'll see how they're going to do it. Yeah. Giuliani is still the head of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, which is a jihadist organization, on our terror list. So there is a risk. Mm-hmm. There is a, you know, an attempt to create the conditions for a reform by this organization. But two conditions are on the front. Number one, hey, recognize Israel. Number two, more important for discussions you and I had, do not persecute the Christians. Do not persecute the Alawis. Do not persecute the Kurds and the Druze. That's the internal challenge. And once President Trump will be back with conversations with Congress, there will be a road plan for HTS, the rulers of Syria, to be accepted fully by the international community.
It's a very practical approach, I have to say, Waleed, using these economic levers to move the culture and the frankly, promote peace and instigate peace in the region that has been elusive for so many years. President Trump also indicated that his administration might accept this gift of a Boeing 747 worth an estimated $400 million as a gift from Qatar. He calls it a great gesture. Lawmakers on both sides have raised questions about this, Waleed, about the ethics of taking this gift. Aren't there security concerns to be considered here, not to mention the ethical questions about, I mean, you're talking about replacing Air Force One or the current Air Force One.
Look, in view of the other dangers that are surrounding us, of the threats of jihadism right and left, yes, I understand those who say accepting a gift, regardless of that gift, if it's 100,000 or if it's hundreds of millions of dollars from Qatar, is a problem because Qatar is at the same time a supporter of Hamas, of many jihadi organizations. Mm-hmm. But in view of the bigger dangers that we have, in view of the fact that this is transparent, I mean, this is a plane that will go to DOD, which will look at it. I don't like the symbolism of it because it's coming from Qatar, but by itself, it's the least of our problems worldwide. And then if it's accepted, if it's checked thoroughly on the security level, I would be worried about other things that Qatar has done, is doing, than, you know, gifting that plane to the U.S. government.
Yeah, well, the government can have it, turn it into a, you know, they can do humanitarian missions during crises and things. Yeah. I don't like the idea of the president running around on it, and certainly not, you know, when you have an entire cabinet officials and given the sensitive communications on Air Force One, I just don't like that. On Wednesday, Israeli airstrikes hit northern and southern Gaza, killing at least 70 people, Waleed, including two dozen children, according to local hospitals and health officials. Now, this was a day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said there was no way he was going to halt Israel's offensive in the Palestinian territory before Hamas is defeated. Waleed, is an end to this conflict even possible anytime soon?
Well, first of all, Raymond, it's taken too long. As a historian, I remember I was a kid at the time in 1967. The Israeli army took Gaza in 3 days. Now it's almost 3 years. And the reason is that the previous administration, the Biden administration, for 2 years and a half, has been delaying Israeli action and calling for ceasefire and calling for negotiations with Hamas. I mean, the Israelis can move, but every time they move, then they have this call for ceasefire. They have to stop. It's more costly because every time they're going to try to move again, Hamas has changed positions. I hate to see children, women, elderly, just people, normal people in Gaza being killed during that action, because I have also been seeing, and I don't know if I reported this to you, that there are thousands of Gazans demonstrating against Hamas. It's online. It's on YouTube. They want this war to end. The Israeli public wants this war to end. So either we're going to go quickly and finish it so there will be no more civilian casualties, or we're going to stay in the same position.
Yeah. Hamas on Monday released an Israeli-American soldier, Idan Alexander, who had been held hostage in Gaza for more than 19 months, Waleed. He's the last American hostage to be released. What do we know about the remaining hostages, and what of the remains of hostages that must be returned at this point?
I remember on the second week after October 7th on your show, I just projected that the reason for why they took all these hundreds and hundreds of hostages is to buy time, is to stretch the time. Mm. They did it in 2 years and a half. They are proposing one hostage, then another hostage, then they suspend the negotiation. And even they could think of keeping a few for them when the leadership may leave the enclave if Israel really takes over. That has been a disaster, keeping those hostages, not resolving that problem for, you know, for the first 6 weeks. And now, of course, they are releasing the last one because they know that at one point, President Trump is going to the region and then proposing a final act in this conflict. So they want the final act to be in their advantage, not in the advantage of the Israelis. That's why they used every single prisoner, every single hostage, till they get to the negotiations, which are underway now, on behalf of the Trump administration and hostages, you know, moderators like Qatar and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Waleed, we have to leave it there. Iran, an imperialist republic, and U.S. policy by Dr. Waleed Faris is available at bookstores everywhere and online. Dr. Faris, thank you.
Thank you so much.
She's an Emmy Award-winning actress for her role as Deborah Barone on the hit CBS sitcom Everybody Loves Raymond, though it's not true. She joins me tonight to talk about a movie she's produced with her husband, David Hunt. It's called Unexpected, a bittersweet family comedy that touches on themes of infertility and adoption. It's currently streaming on Amazon Prime. Here's my interview with Patricia Heaton. Patricia, thank you for joining me. The movie Unexpected features a serious topic, infertility, but it handles it with kind of a quirky humor and a life-affirming plot that discovers joy amidst the sadness and the chaos of these characters' lives. The movie is available now on Amazon Prime Video. How did you first come across the book on which it's based, Enslaved by Ducks?
Yeah, our agent at the time found the book for us, and it was quite charming. And what was interesting, it did not actually have an infertility plot line in it. It was really just about a guy who was kind of depressed, and his wife was collecting a lot of rescue animals. And we had written a script written just based on the book, and it just didn't feel like there was any there. And so we leapt off of the fact that she was taking in all these rescue animals, and we focused in on that maternal energy that people have toward their pets. And we thought, what if the reason she's getting all these animals is because they're struggling with infertility? And that just made the whole movie come alive. And what was really interesting is we suggested this to our writer, and he came back with a rewrite in like 2 weeks, which is very fast. And we said, wow, that was quick. And he said, well, I've never told you, but my two daughters are adopted and we went through this. And so much of what is you see in the movie is verbatim from what he struggled with his own wife and in their marriage. And this is April is the National Infertility Awareness Month. So we wanted to have people become aware of this movie, because I think, you know, there's a lot of the sort of medical aspect of what it takes to, you know, go through all that kind of stuff, IVF, what have you. But there's an emotional toll on a relationship, and it includes men and what they feel about going through it. And in our movie, which, as you said, is done in front of a, kind of a funny, quirky way, is about this couple. She wants to adopt and he doesn't. And it's about trying to get on the same page at the same time and how men emotionally deal with it.
I want to give our audience a little taste of the movie. This is what you can expect. This is Unexpected.
Where does this kind of wood come from, Rupert?
I don't know, Bob. I think it's from a tree.
It might be nice to have a little animal hopping around the house.
We could call him Binky.
Oh, there's a chance that when he bites electrical cords.
I need to take you off Rock and Roll Reviews for a while.
The Underdeath Review. I can't use it.
What was wrong with it?
You just wrote the word lies 9 out of 12 times.
How long did you want it?
Are you fully crazy or just mildly zonked?
I've heard good things about Zoloft.
Well, the lowest dose is 25 milligrams. We could start off with 50.
You're the doctor.
Let's start you off with 100 milligrams.
I'm no longer fit to be with civilized people.
Welcome to my life.
There is a plan for us, and we don't see it yet.
It's a cycle. Running as fast as we can in the wrong direction.
Patty, you and your husband, well, you co-produced this, but your husband, David, directed it. And tell me about the reaction that men had when they watched this film.
Well, even as we were filming it, one of the male crew members came up and he said, "I've never seen a movie where they explored the male emotional side of this topic, and in general, what men go through emotionally in relationships." He goes, "It's really nice to see a movie that really features both the husband and the wife in this situation." And we've had a couple screenings, Raymond, that were really moving. We did one in Chicago, and when we went up for the Q&A, there was silence, and we thought, oh, I don't think anybody liked the movie. And then person after person got up and said, "Thank you for telling our story." And one gentleman said, "You know, I didn't even know why I was coming here. My wife has dragged me to it. I didn't know what the movie was about, but this was our story." And then he started weeping, and he couldn't get through his comment. So it's been a quite a really meaningful response. And we're so happy that so many people felt seen. That's what a lot of people said. We went through this and you captured it. And thank you for putting our story on the screen. Well,
Patty, people don't realize infertility affects over 10 million women in America. That's 12% of the U.S. population, you know, women between 15 and 49, according to the CDC. And yet it remains this subject that few people talk about. How might Unexpected start a conversation about this, the topic of infertility, and how it does affect us all and the impacts it has on us?
Well, you know, I think it's so hard for people who are struggling with it. You know, often you'll say to somebody, "Oh, do you have kids?" And someone will say no. And then you don't know whether to say, "Do you want kids?" Or "Are you choosing not?" Like, it's a topic you can't even begin to go into because it's so personal. And it can be such an emotional minefield for people. And yet our society is really organized around families. Schools, churches, communities, you know, it's all about your kids, you know, for 20 years of your life. So if you're not able to have them, you know, where do you go as a family, as a couple? Where are you going to get the support? And how can you feel a part of a community that's family-centric, that's child-centric when you don't have any? So it's definitely a tough one. We love the approach of trying to find, not like we find humor in the situation, we find humor in the relationships. It's all good comedy comes from pain. You see that in Everybody Loves Raymond. You see it in The Middle. And so I feel like what happens when people laugh, physically, they oxygenate themselves. Their body relaxes and opens up, and then you can receive the sort of deeper message and the moving stuff and the difficult stuff in the movie because you've kind of relaxed and opened yourself up to it. So I always feel that if you can have that humor in something, it makes it more powerful.
Patty, I could not agree with you more, but I had not considered the physical. You know, I always say, try to inject a little humor. You want to make people laugh a bit because they relax and they'll hear you. But I hadn't considered the physical attributes of humor, which is a great insight. You do. You oxygenate. Yeah. And you're sharing something with all the people around you. What do you make of Trump's plan to incentivize childbirth? You saw where he's giving away, essentially trying to build in tax credits for those who have children. A good idea?
Yeah, I mean, I know that for many people, when it comes to things like IVF or whatever, there's theological differences, especially as Catholics, about that. But generally speaking, I think it's the right thing to incentivize people to have families, to make it more affordable, to make adoption easier, because we are in a crisis of low birth rates all over the world. So it's very important, whether you want to think on a global scale, on a national scale, or just personally, you know, it challenges you as a human being to be a parent. And it deepens you and it connects you more to the community because you're bringing kids into a world and you're going to be leaving them in this world. And so it connects you to the world in a way that you hadn't connected before. And I think, you know,
it matters.
I mean, it matters. It matters. And, you know, selfishly as an actor, having children, whether you, you know, have them conceive them naturally, whether you adopt, whichever way your children come to you, it unlocks a chamber of your heart that can only be unlocked by children. And as an actor, it so refocused everything about me. My work became much deeper, but much more efficient because I did not have time outside of rehearsal to worry about it. So I had to get the work done when I was at work because I had to pay attention to my family when I got home. So it did many wonderful things for me. And we have these four beautiful sons and their joy. And I hardly remember any of it because I was doing Raymond and the middle and having four kids all at the same time. So
it's all a blur. No, it is a blur.
It's a blur.
And the days are, but the days are long, but the years are really short. I mean, that's,
exactly.
And that's a weird phenomena we go through. You think this will never end. I'm just bouncing around.
Yes.
I can't keep up. And then all of a sudden they go away, Patty. And it's like, you know, all you want to do is break down in tears because like your life is empty in some ways. Or, you know, you have to readjust your life. You said in 2020, being a mother is indescribable joy, worry, delight, frustration, but ultimately the greatest satisfaction and deepest human love of your life. What encouragement
That's right.
would you give to couples who are unsure about having children? I meet a lot of young couples, Patty, who say, oh, we're going to wait. We're going to wait till we're 35. Or we're going to wait till we're after my career is set or after I get out of graduate school. What would you tell them?
Well, you're never prepared for it. There's no way to prepare for a child. It just upends your life completely. So whether you got through grad school or you didn't, whatever situation you're in, you are going to be completely upended. So there's no perfect time to do it. I think doing it earlier is better if you found your spouse early on in life. Women are just naturally on a biological clock. There's nothing you can do about that. So early is better if that's possible, especially if you don't know whether you're going to be able to conceive. If you wait until you're 35 and then you find out, oh, this isn't going to be as easy as we hoped, there's a lot of pressure there. Dave and I didn't even meet until I was 29 or 30. We didn't have my first one until I was 35. So I'm the example of someone who waited, but fortunately, you know, once we decided the kids came pretty quickly. So that was just the grace of God. But if we had started earlier, we would have probably had five or six kids because as hard as it was, they're so interesting. You're like, you're different. You're different from the last one. What would another one be like?
That's a shocker, Patty, that you think, oh, I have this figured out. And then the second one comes and it's like, what is this
yes.
person? And then the third and it's another, you know, swivel moment. But
and
those
right.
are from the same parents. You know, it's astounding. You
right.
and your husband, David, often work together on projects. How do you balance family life and career? I know, you know, you can't. The problem is you can't escape the workplace. He literally comes home with you.
Yes. You know, we're both actors. We're both opinionated. We both have big egos. So we have had to kind of work at how to work together and, you know, what the hierarchy is and who's in charge on this particular project or on that particular show. You know, and it's a constant thing where we have to keep figuring it out. And it's, you know, we've been married for 4 years, something like that. And we're kind of the Bickersons. Like we, you know, it's two actors. It's like, shouldn't be working at all. Like we didn't be together for 34 years, but here we are. But it's because it's just like a real relationship and you can't let the fact that you have disagreements or personality clashes be a reason that you're not together or not working it out, especially if you have kids.
Patty, as the world commemorates the life of Pope Francis, I know you all had an opportunity to meet him. What was that experience like? What did you take from that encounter with the Holy Father?
Well, he was still pretty fragile. Even back then, that was 2022, and there was a bit of a fragility with him. He was in a wheelchair. But we were there with a number of artists, and it was sort of a meeting of people talking about how to use their gifts that God has given them. in the world of arts. And he talked about the importance of the arts and the importance of putting beauty into the world. And I think, you know, the Catholic Church in its long history has really always glorified God through the arts. And so it was a very meaningful coming together. It's part of our history as Catholics. And, you know, we continue to, when you think of Pope John Paul and that he had started out as an actor, which I always loved, you know, it's wonderful to see, to be a part of that and to know that that's our heritage and that's our calling. You know, it's our calling. Not everybody can be a brain surgeon and not everybody can be a scientist or a banker. Because sometimes I look at what I do and it just seems silly. But somebody's got to make people laugh in this world.
That's right.
And I feel that blessed that God chose me to help make people laugh to get through some of these situations.
We're starved for joy, Patty. And I have to tell you, my wife was recently ill. She had a foot thing, the surgery, and couldn't leave the house. We found Everybody Loves Raymond episodes, and they just were a delight in the middle of the day. You can just sit back and enjoy. Everybody can relate with the foibles of this family. And when you're Italian, you really can relate. And it's just, John Paul was right and Francis was right. Beauty is so needed in the world. And you do a wonderful job doing that and have throughout your career. And especially in this new film as well. So I thank you for bringing it into reality with your hubby. And we'll touch base in the days ahead. And you can go watch Unexpected now on Amazon Prime Video, and I think you should. Thank you, Patty.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Before we go, EWTN's Matthew Bunsen is writing a new book called Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope. It's available for pre-order from the EWTN catalog.
And let me start by saying, pretty amazing you've been able to write this so fast when the world didn't even know who the new pope would be just 8 days ago. My first question to you, my friend, is why was it important for you to have this book out so quickly?
Yeah, it's actually a great question because, as you know, anytime we have a new Holy Father, the world is very curious about him. They want to know as much as they can, as quickly as they can. And one of the things that we realized many years ago, we saw that with Pope Benedict XVI in 2005 and Pope Francis in 2013, is that many of the things that you read or watch in secular media either isn't inaccurate or is sort of a deliberate misrepresentation. So what we want to do with this book is to offer a first portrait of the life, formation, and journey of Robert Francis Prevost from Chicago all the way to Rome, and now, of course, as Pope Leo XIV.
You can pre-order the book now at EWTNRC.com. That's all the time we have for now. Darn it. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.